Deportees amounted to 6,694. The data and evidence reveal conduct that violates the High Court's directive and even the Immigration Authority's own procedures, according to Sigal Rosen from the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants.
Main points we identified were detention of those who denied entry to Israel, preventing those who have been denied entry from applying for asylum when they wanted to. There was, again, cases of violence by immigration authority inspectors towards detainees. And in the last year, there was a special problem of detention of families with children, school children, ahead of their deportation from Israel. During the last year, the Immigration Authority started focusing on efforts to detain school-aged children. This population was previously spared from detention and deportation, but in the last year, the immigration started arresting these children, especially in order to deport them. Unfortunately, the Israeli immigration policy is to allow the immigration of Jews only, and whoever is not Jewish and is not entering to Israel under the law of return, but under the entry to Israel law, the Israeli government is doing whatever in its power to arrest and deport him. Well, if Israel doesn't want non-Jews to live in this country, then they just don't need to bring these people. Right now, and actually anytime, there is more than 100,000 legal migrant workers that the government is initiating their entry into the country. It is not reasonable to invite all these people and then to deport them. And this is already amount to torture. Detaining a migrant who committed no crime just because Israel failed to deport him for such long years without any prospect for release is definitely a torture.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Traf Lab says COVID-19 made the situation of some of the most vulnerable workers worse and introduced some highly restrictive targeted policies that had grave impact on their lives. Hopefully, it also created an opportunity to rethink policies and reassess how to address vulnerabilities. Brin says Israel's crimes include ethnic cleansing, bouts of genocide in Gaza, torture of children, theft of land, targeted killings and murder, house demolitions, and myriads more since the squatter entity was unilaterally declared in Palestine by a Polish immigrant in May 1948.
The facts are that Israel signed the UN Convention on Refugees, which means that they're supposed to give refugees and according to international law, regardless of the convention, but they're supposed to give refugees safe haven if they're leaving from a country where they're in trouble, where they're in danger. And obviously that's not what's really happening on the ground. They face a lot of racism, they face a lot of legal and bureaucratic issues. So on the one hand, on paper, Israel is supposed to be treating them in a different way than what's happening on the ground. Of course, I mean, in any country, when an immigrant or an asylum seeker comes for work or to flee danger, they're obviously at a disadvantage, right? Because of language, because of legal issues, because of all kinds of things, and so it's easy to exploit them. Here, we have a particularly difficult situation because, as I explained, most of the asylum seekers are not getting legal and social help from the government. And so, you know, they need to somehow be able to raise their families, to feed their kids. So if they're, you know, working under the table or working at restaurants and being taken advantage of, the system is sort of set up to do that rather than to help them.
So yes, in general, I think there's a fundamental racist problem in Israel. It has always been an issue in Israel. The targets of the racism have changed. It was either at the beginning, I would say, the Arab population or the Sephardic population, what we call the people that came from north of Africa and Yemen. They suffer from systematic racism towards even from the beginning. And of course, now that we have the Ethiopian Jews that came to Israel 20, 30, 40 years ago, and of course the asylum seekers coming from Africa, they all suffer from a systematic racist problem in Israel. It's quite unbelievable, even. It's heartbreaking, and you can see the results. Actually, the Ethiopian Jews. I was in the trial yesterday of Salomon Tuka, a young Jewish Ethiopian boy that was murdered by the police. Then he was shot by a police officer. We have succeeded to raise awareness, and there's a trial going on, which is quite exceptional. But we know that the trial will not bring anything, and the policeman is not he's not blamed of murdering the boy. He's blamed of, I don't know, some sort of something else. But in general, we have a long list of young Ethiopian boys that are being imprisoned, criminalized, killed. So of course, when it comes to even the Jewish black community, the asylum seekers suffer from it much more. I think basically it stems from the fact that the Jewish community that established the Zionists, that has established Israel, came from Western Europe countries, East European countries. I think they all suffer from racism until today. So basically, I think we brought the racism from Europe to Israel, when you think about the people that established Israel, including my great-grandparents and my family from both sides. So I think they came with the notion that anything that is not European is not equal to them. And of course, I think it had to do with the fact that we had to basically, we're committing ethnic cleansing towards the Arab population in that was here in Palestine. So in order to do that, you have to make them subhuman. And I think that, you know, echoes the way we treated the community, the Jewish community that came, as I said, from the northern part of Africa or from Yemen. They received the same treatment. They have been there. Their culture, their language, everything that they brought with them was valued as not as good as the coming things that came from east of Europe. So basically, I think it's something that's rooted in the Zionists and the Jewish society here in Israel.
The daunting report reveals a sharp increase in the number of immigrant families imprisoned for the purpose of deportation from Israel. And for the first time, it also aimed to detain students. Such torture of migrants is not new. In 2018, the United Nations said that migrants in Israel suffered from abuse and torture before they were ultimately deported. The UN refugee conducted research into the subject and highlighted 80 individual cases of people who risked their lives after they were relocated by Israel and then had to make hazardous journeys to Europe through Libya. The UN said that migrants suffered abuse, torture, and extortion before risking their lives once again by crossing the Mediterranean to Italy after Israel had sent them away. In April 2018, Israel reached an agreement with the United Nations to expel around 16,000 African migrants to Western countries in exchange for granting temporary residency in Israel to the same number. Shortly after, however, the deal was canceled by the Israeli regime.
these years, actually, since 2013, when Israel started sending asylum seekers to Rwanda and Uganda, only asylum seekers who decided to move to these countries left. No one was taken there by force. It is correct that many of them felt coerced to go there because of the heavy decrees and laws that locked them down in prison, in Cholot, all the economic decrees that took away such a large amount of their salaries and left them with no means to live. The international law brutally when it deals with both asylum seekers and migrant workers. We see in the case of migrant workers that people are detained in illegal condition, not just according to international law, but also according to the Israeli law. And regarding asylum seekers, we see that Israel do not bother to check the asylum claims, detain them, coerce them to move to other country, and limit their freedom of movement in a way that violates the Refugee Convention.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Suburb says that an Israeli court rules the city to be a white city and that schools for blacks or funding transport for black school children to attend school elsewhere are liable to alter the city's demographic balance. This could incentivize blacks to move into the city, damaging its white character. Fatima says that the crimes that are happening all over the world against the oppressed Yemenis, Palestinians, Afghans, Indians, Chinese, blacks, etc. are being planned by the United States and Israel. The international community must protest against these atrocities. Ali says the extinction of insects and reptiles is important to the United Nations.
And there are different types of immigrants in Israel. There are migrant workers and there are asylum seekers, as I said. But it's very, very difficult to naturalize in Israel if you're not coming and making aliyah, if you're not coming as a Jew from a different country and trying to live here permanently. It's nearly impossible to naturalize here, including if you're an immigrant, a non-Jewish immigrant that wants to marry or marries outside of the country a citizen. So there's a lot of bureaucracy, and the legal system is not set up to help migrant workers and refugees, and this is why they're a vulnerable community in Israel. And so, you know, even things like getting social services during a global pandemic, as I said, the deposit law was canceled, but there are lots of other issues and social benefits that other people living here, citizens mainly, are receiving that these people are not receiving because they're not really recognized.
And I'm here in order to make a change. We have a prime minister who's divisive, who is splitting the country, who is ruining our economy, and who is undermining the structure of democracy.
I'm coming here to protest for 6 months because our Prime Minister has he's criminal, and he's kind of dictator, and we want him out.
Basically, Israel does not respect any international law. It doesn't respect international law, the refugee convention. The Geneva Convention, sorry. It has never been committed to anything in the Geneva Convention. Convention regarding asylum seekers, regarding refugees, but it also does the same thing towards the Palestinians. There are no international laws, none whatsoever, that Israel respects. Even the deportation, they found a system with these third countries, I call them the revolving doors, Rwanda and Uganda, which they did not even allow to say their name in court. By the way, I went to Uganda, and we also had connections with parliament members of Uganda. That's one of the reasons that his program has failed. We collected testimonies, and we know that Israel has done everything it's in its power to either walk around these international laws or disregard them in general. I would even say that the Supreme Court of Israel itself does not respect the international law. It doesn't say so out front, but it definitely does everything in its power to override these international laws. Pressure and create a change? No. Public pressure, if it's not, governments cannot create a change, okay? The whole BDS movement, which basically Israel is very worried by it, cannot really create change, because we're not talking about governments. We're talking about private people, NGOs, or whatever. If the only way, I think, basically, if you ask me, and this is what we have worked towards with 2018, when we were hoping that the deal with the UN would go through, Israel will never accept its small amount of asylum seekers. We're talking about a very small, we're talking about less than 30,000 asylum seekers that are even not called asylum seekers. They're called infiltrators. They're called infiltrators by the court, by the Supreme Court. No, these people will never receive fair treatment. They will never be considered human beings, basically.
The migrants that have been tortured include workers that have been working in Israel for decades. They are cheap labor and working conditions that Israeli employees do not. They do not receive any incentives or benefits. In fact, many of them do not see their paychecks in years. Israel has been allowing this to go on for decades. To many of these migrants and laborers, they are being treated as modern-day slaves. Israel has promised them savings forcefully cut from their paychecks if they leave. Israel has been wanting them to leave for years. Now, it is executing mass imprisonment of this minority group of people. It remains to be seen what actions the UN will take after the latest torture report in Israel. Here is the news making the press in Israel. The Jerusalem Post. The father of Facebook Israel CEO and an active protester against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was killed after being struck by a car during an anti-Netanyahu protest at the entrance of the city of Sabion. Police ruled out any intention to harm by the driver, a woman in her 20s. The Times of Israel. Hackers published sensitive client information stolen from Sherbet Insurance after the company refused on Friday to pay the approximately $1 million ransom demanded. The group responsible for the attack, Black Shadow, had said that if the requested sum of now 200 bitcoins was transferred into its account, it would not publish or sell the information. I-24 News. Amir Peretz, Israel's economy minister and head of the Labor Party, announced that he will be running for Israel's presidency in 2021. Peretz, who was the military minister during the 2006 Second Lebanon War, made the announcement in an interview with Army Radio. Israel's current president, Reuven Rivlin, is set to step down in mid-2021, with the Knesset, Israeli parliament, tasked with electing the next president. Ynet News. Two Israeli teenagers have been arrested on suspicion of sexually abusing two small children over a period of 2 years, the police said. According to the police, some of the abuses of the children, aged 4 and 7, took place inside a local synagogue. During the covert probe, the investigators gathered findings and collected evidence from several children, which helped them to uncover the affair.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Second phase of the revolution.
Of the revolution. Of the revolution.
Leap in production. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Many experts believe that convertible industries are the prerequisite for industrialization and food security. The highest rate of convertible industries is related to the agricultural sector. This sector plays a significant role in the process of production as it increases productivity and creates value added in production of the final product. Moreover, expansion of food industries in the provinces with potentials of agriculture, especially on borders, will boost job creation and exports to neighboring countries. Moving in this course with focusing on leap in production will bring about positive results in the economic growth as it will lead to flourishing of economy in macro scale. One of the important indices of agricultural and horticultural crops is the way of productivity. This shows that according to diverse products, how much of these products are capable of converting to packaging and conserve industries with long durability. Reinforcing this sector will not only enhance foreign exchange in exports sector, it will also make the country self-sufficient and secure in agricultural and food needs. For this reason, developed countries try to make the best use of technology to increase the share of industry and services to grow gross domestic production. The most advanced countries consider the development of agriculture as the complementary of industry. Regarding the role of agriculture in green economy, convertible industries play a key role in the development of Iran, and paying attention to this sector will contribute to the growth of agriculture and economy. With respect to shortage of water in many regions in Iran, this will lead to the increase of quality of products and higher value added will be gained. Apple, apricot, nectarine, almond, cherry, plum, and walnut are among the horticultural products that grow in various climates in Iran. For instance, the black grape of Sarvabad in Kurdistan province is a top brand which is cultivated completely by dry farming and has a high value. Each of the mentioned crops is capable of turning into food industries. Agricultural products enjoy two general features of being seasonal and decaying. These features cause risks for food security in the country as they cannot be available in all seasons of year. The scale of food security will increase in the country when people are able to get access to their desired products at any time, at any place, with suitable price. This will not be feasible except with development of food industries because it will promote the capacity of procession of agricultural products and will solve the problem of being seasonal. The convertible and complementary industries in agriculture will also reduce poverty and discrimination due to the spread of agriculture in rural areas.
Agriculture is in fact one of the relative privileges in exports markets and plays a significant role in prosperity of exports and garnering foreign exchange. In view of this, converting agricultural crops into products with value added will both absorb more foreign exchanges and increase the durability of products in markets. This can turn agriculture into one of the most lucrative industries in economy. This trend will cause sustainable job creation in rural areas, will reverse migration from villages, and will increase food security. It will also contribute to the growth of gross domestic production, development of non-oil exports via creation of value added in raw agricultural crops, and strengthen food security. Generally speaking, convertible industries play a key role in the process of the country's development because through specialization of the products of this sector, productivity of agricultural crops will increase and will make agricultural activities more profitable. Eventually, agricultural and economic growth will be accelerated in the country. Convertible and complementary industries are so important that they rank second in the world in terms of vastness after heavy industries. According to statistical figures in Iran, food industries shape more than 85% of convertible and complementary industries in agriculture sector. Therefore, with respect to the direct and indirect effects of these industries in production and job creation, strengthening this sector will result in the growth and thriving of economy in general. Simply put, agriculture cannot be successful without the strengthening and balanced development of convertible industries. These industries are indeed the precursor of the strategy for industrialization. Hence, one of the important objectives of leap in production is the increase of food security in the country with reliance on production from domestic resources.
European News Bulletin.
Good to have you with us. My name is Amina Taylor, broadcasting from the British capital, London. Now we kick off with a developing story after the European Parliament voted to lift the immunity of the former president of Spain's Catalonia region, Carles Puigdemont, and two of his pro-independence associates. Puigdemont and his colleagues became members of the European Parliament in 2019. This after they fled Spain following their failed pro-independence Catalan referendum bid, which was deemed illegal by Spanish authorities. Following the EU's announcements, Puigdemont's pro-Catalan party stated that they will not give up the fight for independence. The three individuals now face being extradited to Spain, which has issued European arrest warrants for the trio. Chris Bambury is with me, the political commentator and author of the book Catalonia Reborn, How Catalonia Took on the Corrupt Spanish State and the Legacy of Franco. You've been watching this for some time. Are you surprised that the EU did this?
No, I'm not surprised. The Spanish are desperate to get Puigdemont and the other two back to put them in jail, as with the other Catalan leaders who were sentenced to Oriol Junqueras, for instance, to 13 years for organising this referendum. I think the result was not going to be in any surprise. The three major blocs in the European Parliament, the centre-right blocs and the socialist centre-left blocs, had all agreed they were going to vote for this. But actually, the result was much closer than would be expected. 58% voted for lifting the immunity, and you could do the rest of the arithmetic. A substantial minority voted against. And this was the first time that the Catalan issue has really erupted into the European Parliament and European institutions. Since that October referendum, which was suppressed by the Spanish using paramilitary police, the EU has stayed quiet on the question of Catalonia and what's happening there, because essentially it supports Spain. Now we have a debate in Europe about what is going on, not just in Catalonia, but inside Spain. We should remember as well.
Dear listeners, here we interrupt the normal course of our program to have the live coverage of the leader of Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's speech on the occasion of Eid al-Mab'ath. Let's take a listen.
Peace and blessings be upon Prophet Muhammad. Let me offer felicitations on the auspicious Mab'ath festivity, ordained to the Prophethood of Muhammad. Congratulate the entire freedom lovers of the world. This festivity belongs to all people who are seeking justice in the world, and also a warning to the Islamic community. There's a point that I would like to make regarding this occasion, regarding the ordainment to prophethood, and also a few statements about issues related to the Islamic revolution. Now, during this Islamic occasion, on such a day, the heart of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, functioned as the highest and the most invaluable treasure, heavenly treasure, that was inspiration that he received, and the heaviest burden and responsibility of the world of existence was laid upon his shoulder. That was the responsibility to guide human being to the end, to the last day of the world. Of course, this ordainment to prophethood was also a magnificent gift to all humanity. By Besat in Arabic word, it means to kind of instigate and to choose the person who is picked by the Almighty God. That's he's a messenger. He's a messenger of God. And when you push the person to rise up, then that's intermingled with his connection and proximity to the infinite power and heavenly knowledge. And this is the great phenomenon of ordaining to prophethood. He's assigned to prophethood. And then in a later stage, this phenomenon that happens on the to the Prophet of Islam, that will also lead to inciting and moving, getting other human beings to move. I mean, the Prophet, in each era of any prophet, of the Divine Prophet, after they are assigned to prophethood, then there are human societies that they push to move. And that's in the direction of a new path, a new course that would lead to prosperity of human being. That's what we mean by the Arabic word Besat, that's assignment to prophethood. Now all prophets in their assignment to prophethood, there have been certain divine objectives and goals, naturally the goal of the Prophet of Islam would be what God has assigned for him. So assignments to prophethood have certain, envisage certain great aspirations, and one of them being monotheism. It's a great the goal of the Espirituality or the Mental Prophethood. As the Holy Quran says, this is pure monotheism. And this Quranic verse appears in Nahl chapter, in Araf chapter, also Hud chapter, a number of prophets like Noah, like Saleh and others, they are also quoted as saying, and his reciting it in Arabic. This is the monotheism, which is the primary goal of prophethood. And of course, by monotheism, Tawhid in Arabic, it doesn't mean that you believe in your mind that there is only one God and not two. Well, that's also part of it, but it does not limit to that. By monotheism, it's a profound concept. And that means divine rule. That means absolute rule of God over both worlds. That's what monotheism is all about. Divine rule should permeate whatever happens in the physical world and in the other world. All these developments, they all emanate from and arise from the soul power of the unit of God. This is one of the goals, one of the mysteries, for example. The spiritual, let's say, cleansing of human beings from all, any kind of ills, any kind of decadence, source of decadence. It's the teaching of human beings, it's elevating and promoting knowledge of human beings. It's also the spread of justice that human society. You should see justice is spread all over human society. These are parts of the main goals of the assignment to prophethood of different people. It's also creating this, what is called as pure life. And by that, we mean growth and development and flourish of knowledge and of mankind. And also, peace and calm, material welfare, so security and a safe environment for human being to live, welfare and also feeling of jubilation and joy. And on top of them all is the spiritual perfection of human being. That's what we mean by pure life. These are goals of the assignment to prophethood. Now, of course, here we mean by the great and prophets of God. There have also been some other prophets that they have been propagating these facts. You know, they were dispatched to different parts of the world to go about their mission. Now, so as you see, these are some great and lofty aspirations. Now, how are they going to be achieved? These are really difficult to achieve. Well, in the first place, they need some sort of extensive planning on different social occasions. When the Prophet of Islam, the Messenger of God, at any time, an era of a juncture of history, if at any time, if they want to see these goals realized, they will have to embark on some social issues proportionately. Now, the second point is that it's a political power. I mean, these social ties, an isolated person who just gives people advice, he's not able to create that. He needs political clout. So all these occasions are intermingled with a great political power and also extensive planning to see these objectives realized. So we have this political system or mechanism that's created by prophethood. That's the main goal. So there's a political system in place. So as to which prophet gets the chance or the opportunity to do this or not to do that, that's a different issue. So therefore, the goal is to create this political system in place, to put it in place, so that these goals could be realized by establishing social relations and various kinds of human relations, though they could move toward realizing those objectives. Now, in that political system or mechanism, the procedure, the ways of governance, this is what is adapted from the Holy Book that God descends upon the prophets. And it is said in the Holy Book that we have ordained the prophets to give warnings, as the Holy Quran says, and we also give them the book so that they would pass judgment. That means that Holy Book is the one that rules. That's as a yardstick to decide what they need to do. That's the arbiter or the yardstick for all social. This appears in chapter Baqarah, and also in Al Imran chapter we have another verse. That's it. We told them the one. I mean, Bible is there as the source of reference. So all the orders should emanate from the Bible for those who follow that Holy Book. And also for other prophets, it's also mentioned elsewhere. We have, for example, this verse that I'm reciting now. These are different Quranic verses. In all of these verses, what is a source, an origin of rule and source and reference for ruling, and everything emanates from that, it's the very same Holy Book that's descended upon the Holy Prophet. So this is the basis, this is the foundation. All plans need to be decided accordingly. So this is how to rule or govern. Now, who should act upon this rule of governance? Now, without a management system, without a command center, this cannot be put into practice. So there some management is needed here. And then the leading and instruction to the people, and this goes back to Prophet himself, the Holy Prophet. I mean, the Prophet of Islam and prophets before him, his predecessors, and they were all directors or, let's say, commanders who need to embark on religious and faith-based guidance of the society and leadership of the society on the basis of the Holy Book. This is what they're responsible to do. Of course, this command or leadership is not, does not appear only in one form. On certain occasions, the Prophet himself takes responsibility and leads things forward, like David, Prophet David, or Solomon, or the Holy Prophet of Islam. They themselves were standing at the very forefront, and they took the helm of affairs themselves. At times, it happens to be like this, and on other occasions, we have the prophet who designates a ruler as ordered by God's injunction, like the prophet who, in the Baqarah chapter, we have a verse that says people who were under pressure, they had some suffering, they went to the prophet and asked him to pick them a ruler, and he picked a ruler for them. And then the verse goes on and says that Khalid became commander, he was assigned as ruler. So the prophet shows the way, he's the leader, he's the main commander-in-chief. But things could be executed by someone else other than the prophet, and here we have, for instance, Khalid. And there have been some other instances regarding other junctures of history and other prophets. And At times, it's not like this. I mean, the Prophet himself does not. The Prophet himself has a certain position in the within the governance system, like, for example, the other Prophet that we have Joseph, for instance. And during that era, you know, that political system also kind of turned to his faith, and Joseph himself was running everything, and he was at the same time not a commander, but he was acting as an executive body. So this is the what we mean by Bezat. So that means actually inciting, provoking somebody to take some action. That's what we mean by that. We that the whole of the book is ordered to be acted accordingly. Is the whole of the book is descended on the Prophet, and it. Prophet always acts upon the Holy Book and the contents of the rule and the governance system. The Prophet of God acts according to them and embarks on leadership in different ways that I just mentioned. Maybe there are some other ways and manners, of course, and we have not seen other than that in the Holy Quran, but they may exist, though we are not aware of the whole things that happened in history. So this is the big picture that the religion has. When we look at things this way, through this prism, it means a director or executive of, it's a comprehensive plan into, for the human being. It's not only a personal plan, not only religious and plans for supplication and that kind of thing. So this is what some people think, that the religious means only it's a personal set of teachings and precepts, political, social, economic issues. They're separate things from religion. That's not the case. So this outlook shows that religion is broad-based, is pretty comprehensive, and encompasses all aspects of life. So if when you look at it this way, then religion it has its own enmity. At all times, we have had some evil wishers who stood against this religion. They tried either to, let's say, try to undermine and downplay this great expanse, and they tried to break it down to personal issues, or they could stand against the religion directly, as it is said in the Holy Book, that this is the Quran, chapter 41. It says, any prophet has his own enemies from among the culprits, from among sinners and the evil people in the world. In an chapter also, we have this verse that says, for all the prophets, we have assigned certain enemies, be it from jinns or Satan. This is what's also mentioned in an chapter. So when we have the person assigned as prophet, he's ordained to prophethood, then this is the mechanism to act upon God's rule and governance. When this is raised, then the corrupt people, the aggressors, the colonizers, and you know, other people, they stand against them, they oppose them. Those looters also stand against them. The despots also oppose them, because it's against looting, against plundering, against unrightful domineering and ruling over human beings. So these evildoers of the world, all of them would naturally stand against the Prophet, and that's what you see today happen. You see these days, let's say, in the propaganda launched by the enemies, they use something, they mention something as called political Islam. Political Islam is what you see in the Islamic establishment in Iran. This is in place in Iran. I will later mention the points that our great Imam Khomeini made. And political Islam has becomes a target of this. This is the Islam that has been able to put in place some governance systems and economic, social, political, military and systems are put in place by this. And it has this religious, let's say, identity that's created for the people. That's what they call political Islam. So the definition of Quran, the Quranic definition of religion is what I just told you. You cannot, undermine it and say it's only limited to worship and supplication issues, and it's a personal thing. You cannot do that. So that's what I should tell you about the Besa. So it's a great movement which has a comprehensive plan for salvation of humanity. That's what is put at the disposal of human beings, and it prepares mankind for a great strike. Of course, when you have the ordainment of the prophets, when they're assigned to prophethood, it doesn't mean that people are stripped from taking action. That's not the case. As I said, when the person is assigned as a prophet, then that leads automatically to the people making human beings and others to take action and to make a move, to make a headway. It gets the people moving. So that's what the Imam Ali, peace be upon him, says in his famous sermon. The treasures of knowledge and wisdom that are revived within human souls, and they're made, they're pushed to move. You know, it awakens, it incites their latent instinct, nature, and gets them moving. This is what the Prophet of Islam also says. The Imam Ali says regarding the Prophet in Nahj al-Balagha that. What it says, which means it has both the treatment, the cure, and you know, there were some, maybe some potions, something, some kind of there would be this hot, maybe iron rod that they would touch the wound with, they would apply to the wound and to cure the wound. So that iron bar is called Maysam in Arabic, or Mosam sometimes. So this is what the Prophet of Islam prepared the dressing, maybe, for once, let's put it that way. And also he used those necessary, you know, equipment and tools that were needed in order to take care of that wound. And then he, whatever needed, whatever necessary, some potions were made, and some other times, or some medicine were made, and some other times, maybe those iron, hot iron bars are needed that they applied on the wound to treat the wound in different ways. That's how things are about. Now, as for the issues of the related to the Islamic Revolution, the great Islamic Revolution in Iran. This is what renewed the concept of prophethood and assignment of prophethood. I mean, God Almighty gave this opportunity and blessing to the late Imam Khomeini to tread on the continuous and constant path of the Prophet's course. On the back of his own bravery, courage, and sagacious wisdom. This is what the late Imam Khomeini managed to do. That's the very same course of Besa, that the course of time. It had kind of faded away. The late Imam Khomeini managed to bring it back to life and revive it. And he showed the comprehensiveness of Islamic precepts and teachings in practice. And he showed that in practice that Islam is an all-sided and comprehensive religion, and it covers, encompasses all aspects of human life. This is what the late Imam Khomeini brought it to the fore and brought it under a spotlight. Some certain things were forgotten, but he reminded this, as we're also instructed to do. That's what the late Imam Khomeini did. So this revolution, on the basis of the prophetic ordainment, It was against aggression, it was against despotism, and also it stood against world arrogance. It stood for and supported for the oppressed, no matter which religion they believe in. All those people who are oppressed, the religion followed to those oppressed people, no matter what nation, nationality they came from, what religion they believed in. And at all times, this revolution would call the entire human being to move on the right path of Islam. That's what the invitation was extended. So this was the basic fundamental movement by the Islamic revolution. So when this revolution emerged, and there was this governance system that was put in place, that's the Islamic Republic of Iran. So the very same thing that happened to Prophet, it was repeated. I mean, the evil doers of the world all stood against and formed a rank against Islam, as they did against the holy prophets. So for all prophets, there were certain enemies that stood against them. All the evildoers, all the criminals, all those aggressors and bullies, they formed ranks and stood against the Islamic revolution. So history got repeated. And that was that was what we expected. We never expected them to, let's say, for them to get along with the revolution. It would be it was clear as they that the same thing would happen. It was evident that they would be antagonistic regarding this revolution with such characteristics. I mean, that the Soviet Union at that time, the America, that they would always stand against this revolution, and that's what happened. So this confrontation is definitely there, but when it came to this confrontation or clash against the Islamic revolution, they also embarked on lying and fabrications. They said that the Islamic Republic never gets along with anyone on the planet, and they're in cult. This is not true. That's a lie. We have learned from the Holy Book, from the Holy Quran, that those who do not feel amicable toward the Islamic Republic, we want should be nice to them. We should be nice to them. This is what it says in Montaigne chapter. That's what the Quran says. When those people, the infidels that are not fighting, they're not going to fight you, there is no antagonistic feeling in practice. You need to be kind to them. That's what the Quran says. You need to see justice restored, and that's what God wants to happen. This is what the Holy Quran orders us to do, to be kind to them. If they're not going to fight us, we're not going to fight them. We're going to be kind to them. That's not true. We're not going to fight anyone, those who are not our enemies, no matter what religion they believe in, what nationality they have. We got no issues with them, no problems. We'll even be kind to them. This is what the emphasis that the Islam lays on, confronting the enemy, those who stand against you as enemy. Not those who believe in a different religion. They are not enemies. I mean, inside the country, there is this group of, some elites that a while ago we had these people, and sometimes it's repeated again, that they have this concept of thinking otherwise. I mean, thinking in a different way, it's no problem. Okay, you have a different belief, no problem. That's fine. We have nothing wrong with that. I mean, you shouldn't act like an enemy. That's what the Quran is emphasizing. No matter what you think, doesn't matter what your ideology is. So in chapter 10, it says, this is what the Quran says, that you don't be friends with them. Do not consider them as allies, those who are my enemies and your enemies. They are enemies of God, they're enemies of Islamic society, Islamic community. Also, we have the other Quranic verse that says, prepare whatever you have in your resources in order to stand against them. And it also says, they fight God and you creating power, creating the military prowess, and making armaments, and empowering yourself for that cause is because they want to intimidate or frighten the enemy, not people other than the enemy. So this is what Islam is stressing, that's confronting the